sorry to say, folks, that we missed part of the recording of this show, and consequently the first few minutes of the show were lost. Sorry about that, but there's nothing else we can do at this point. Enjoy the rest of the show. Lots of good information, and I'm sure you'll be happy. Thanks.
Yeah, okay, so they can hear me. I've got one. All right.
Well, we have at least one. This is good.
Well, Phil's a longtime listener, so I can count on him. If he's on, then I know the system's working. But
if it's you, me, and Phil, we have a show.
Yeah. Thanks, Phil. All right, so we'll pick up where we left off. All right, so yep. We're done with winter, and you're going to move on to summer, I think, and talk about there. So go ahead.
Yep, and I always categorize those two seasons together just because they tend to be the ones that are more difficult than say, spring and fall. At least around here, we have much better, more ideal temperatures, conditions, food sources, and everything that make the game quite different. But I tend to like winter and summer every bit as much. I like the difference in the challenge and how you have to change your game and be creative to go after them at those times of the year. But summer for me, I tend to watch the temperatures in terms of warming up and particularly the surface temperatures in the lakes. And I know in my area here, it tends to be less severe of an issue as it might be in other areas of the country. But I'll look for not just how warm it's getting and how that affects the lake surface, but moreover the stability of the temperatures. And this summer here, you and I were talking off the air about kind of the record that we had set here in Washington with stable weather and dry weather and warm weather here. It's been quite unusual for us this year, but it's a good example that no matter how warm it gets, if you have stability, the fish, trout, tend to adjust to that and get used to it, get comfortable with it. And so you can find that maybe when normally temperatures into the 80s and 90s might present a problem, if it's been there for a while and the fish have had a chance to adjust, what I found is that they just keep right on going, and you can have some pretty good days once you have kind of stable weather going on, and regardless of what the temperatures are. So there's that, and then there are certain areas, certain lakes, depending on the topography and where they're located, and we have some that are closer to marine air than others that they tend to have cooler lake surfaces. And so I'll kind of gravitate toward those waters. And for doing this for a number of years, I've kind of figured out what my favorite places are and what tends to be the most productive in the summertime. So I'll look at it kind of high level like that and look for sort of the most ideal places in terms of what weathers the higher temperatures better than others. And then, of course, you have better clues, better food sources than you typically do in the wintertime around here. However, of course, compared to spring and fall, they don't tend to provide quite the same action on the fly. But so you have to be here a little bit more creative, again, like winter, and finding sort of the best window of the day. And if, let's say, what's on the menu the most is going to be damsels or midges or whatever it may be, to try and key in on that and figure out, you know, between that and however the temperatures may be affecting the water and the surface, sort of when that ideal time is that the food is there and that it's most comfortable and safest to feed and everything. And a lot of times it's just a matter of going out there and arranging your schedule such that you can put in the time and just be out there and observe. And so a lot of it's that.
Yeah, in the wintertime, the fish are more lethargic, right, because of the cold
weather,
and they're not feeding as much. But there's almost the same kind of thing can happen in midsummer too, right?
It's interesting that way. So when I find that they tend to be less energetic, it comes back to when there's been less stability in the temperatures and the conditions, and it's a change in temperatures or conditions or a spike versus it being, you know, a certain level of hot or cold that tends to make them react that way, what I find. So in the wintertime, more often than you would think, I've been surprised actually by not just the activity in the water, but how energetic they are when they come up. And in summer, I'm a lot more sensitive to that. And so if I go out in an outing and they're really not showing themselves to be all that enthusiastic in the fight or anything, I might decide to opt out and pick a different day. But it's surprising if you can find the better locations, and I was just talking about sort of picking your favorite handful of lakes that tend to weather the summer better, then they have these lower temperatures down in the toward the bottom of the lake, let's say, where they won't necessarily be as affected, and surprisingly, you can get a lot of good action and really energetic fish when you wouldn't otherwise expect it, or when in most lakes, not so much. It's just a matter of figuring out sort of where those places are.
And then the spring and the fall, well, the spring, they're hungry coming out of the winter and active,
yep.
And fall, they're bulking up for the winter, right? So
yeah.
You have a
yeah.
lot more activity then, I suppose.
Yeah, and I think the main point being, and again, around this area, it's a great example. It's kind of like no 2 years are the same, and particularly in terms of the timing. So spring doesn't necessarily happen in the middle of March around here. It's all about what weather conditions are doing and how soon it heats up. And, of course, that's directly related to, you know, when all the food sources. I always watch for the early midge hatches in the spring, and I have found that to happen where I fish as early as mid to late February, and a lot of times, you know, you're getting closer into April in the same areas before you're seeing that go on. But it's always driven by, okay, winter temperatures around here are actually going to warm up. And so here, that's kind of where we get those swings where you never know, and maybe it's going to be a real wet, rainy, cold spring.
Right.
And at other times, you know, you would swear that we just skipped right into summer. It just all depends.
Yeah.
So I tend to not necessarily look on the calendar. I watch the weather.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's the same here in Colorado. We have that same kind of activity going on. We got a question here from Jeff Ewing in Erie, Colorado. He says, what impact does fall turnover have on fish?
Oh, so first of all, Jeff, I circled your name. You're one of the people who sent more than one question, and so I was going to put a big shout-out and a thank you for actually spending the time and having that kind
yeah.
of enthusiasm. So I'm more than flattered. But so, yeah, note to that, I circled you. So about that, so in my experience, a lot of times I'll sort of make inferences or draw conclusions that that's what's going on. And admittedly, sometimes when there's lack of a better explanation, but I can think of a good handful of times when you go out and you have a certain expectation and nothing's happening and you give it some more time and everything, and I'll start to kind of suspect that there's some form of turnover going on, and I'll sort of look for the signs of that. And admittedly, again, I have kind of limited experience with that. I can't say I'm necessarily a turnover expert, but I've certainly looked for that and observed for that occurrence, and kind of looked for, you know, the typical signs in the water that may kind of tip you off that that's what's going on. But it seems to me that you'll get kind of a, I don't know if I want to call it a dead week or two period of time. I would probably call it more of a dull period where you have this noticeable slowing in the action, and it kind of goes opposite to what you would expect it to be. And so I'm not a person that could say, oh, for sure, it's either in turnover or it's in this phase of it or anything, but you can draw some pretty healthy conclusions about it. But here in this area, we don't find that, you know, every other time out that you're seeing that that's a big thing that's going to have effect, and everybody's worried about, you know, or is there going to be a big turnover issue? It's less common. I'd say in a typical year, I don't necessarily run into it. So it's more a matter of, let's say, every second or third year, I'll run across what I think is a turnover situation going on. And usually the way I'll kind of address that is depending on sort of what I'm finding in a day, and if it's just slower action, I'll look for kind of creative ways to work around it. Or I might simply choose to go find a different lake. And I think you find that that's going to occur differently in each lake in terms of how it goes off and the timing of it and everything. And I wish I had a lot better answer to offer that, because I think it's a really interesting phenomenon that goes on. But certainly from what limited amount I have seen, it definitely affects the bite.
Right, right. Well, time to take a quick break here. And when we come back, we'll talk about equipment a little bit and lines and so forth. So hang tight with us, and we'll be right back. Watermaster is dedicated to providing their customers with the highest quality inflatables on the market, as well as an unbeatable customer service and product support. They are best known for their signature products, the Watermaster Grizzly and Kodiak rafts. These rafts are lightweight, compact, durable, versatile, and safe. The Watermaster rafts are everything your personal watercraft should be. They have been used by anglers and hunters all over the world for over 15 years, including Dave Whitlock, one of fly fishing's greatest innovators. Dave said, "With my Watermaster, I can enjoy more fishing per hour than any other method I have ever tried. After 2.5 years of testing 15 models of kickboats, I'm convinced that the Watermaster is the ultimate personal flotation craft for warm and cold water fly fishing." Visit Watermaster today and take a look at the ultimate personal flotation craft. Go to BigSkyInflatables.com. That's BigSkyInflatables.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Tim Lockhart about Stillwater Simplified. If you'd like to ask Tim a question, just go to our homepage, AskAboutFlyFishing.com, and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. So, Tim, I always ask my guests, you know, what's going on in your fly fishing world. So you just finished this book, right? That's a huge accomplishment. So tell us a bit about that.
Yes, thank you. So the book officially dropped on August 20th, so pretty recently. And I think it was actually out on the market perhaps a month ahead of that. But so far, that's been really good, and I was terribly excited to see the finished product that Stackpole had come up with. And this time versus the first book, they went to color photos and the way they did the layout and everything down to the cover, which they actually selected the photo for the cover. And I'm glad they did, because they saw something in that picture that I never would have seen. And I had suggested a completely different set of photos for a possible cover. So I'm grateful that they're experts at that versus my capabilities. But I was really impressed with the end product there. So I'm quite excited to have it finally out in circulation. And of course, what comes in on the heels of that typically, for those that write books, is you get reactions from, in this case, a lot of the local clubs that want to have you come out. And so there's probably a good a year period where you're going to hear from them, and I can go out and do presentation and sign books and basically spend an evening with a club. So it's a well-timed question. Most recently, I heard from the Inland Empire Fly Fishing Club in Spokane, and they invited me out less than a week ago to spend an evening with them. And the way these go is it's not a real kind of rigid, involved, formal presentation that you do. It's more an evening of fun, and where I can spend time and field a lot of questions from the members of the club, and it's really it's a relaxed atmosphere and a lot of jokes being cracked and a little of this and that being eaten and drank. And so it's a lot of fun, and in that case, I was taken out the next morning to go fish a local lake in the area that I wouldn't have otherwise known about. And so it ends up being a nice sort of a boondoggle trip, and it's a whole lot of fun. So you spend kind of a year doing things like that, and it's kind of a privilege for me to be able to go out and meet people and spend time like that. And yeah. So it's a whole lot of fun.
Good, good. Well, congratulations on that, and I'm sure you'll do well with that. And like you said, yeah, there are a lot of nice color pictures in it. Yeah, you know, Stackpole's gone to this kind of new format, I noticed.
Yeah.
In fact, our next guest in 2 weeks is going to be Dave Kurzinski on Smallmouth, and it's the same format, size, and same kind of production as yours. So they must be coming out with a new format anyway, so that's interesting. Well, good.
Yeah, that's been really good to be a part of.
Yeah, fun. Let's talk. We do have some questions on equipment. First up, what weight and length rod do you usually use on still waters?
So that's kind of that's an easy one for me to answer, and you'll find that I tend to be a bit simplistic, and I tend to travel really light when I go. But in my case, I have a 9-foot rod, 5-weight that I use with kind of an older. A lot of you probably remember the old Bat and Kill reels that Orvis had. I know there's a newer version of it out now, but I went with one. I think it's one of the old Bat and Kill disc reels, and you'll know what I mean. Once you have all of your spools to go with the set and everything, you tend to want to die with it. And so I'm still hanging on to it. And in lakes, I think you have a lot more kind of wiggle room as far as the gear you're using and have it being a little bit less critical as far as how it performs and everything. So I've kind of stuck with what I know and what works. And a lot of guys will say, hey, if you're down in the position in a float tube like I am all the time, you know, go to a 10-foot rod or something that's a bit longer, and that'll make the cast easier. And I certainly wouldn't steer anybody away from that train of thought. It all just comes down to what works best for the individual, and I would venture so far as to say that, you know, a certain person might even take an 8-foot rod in a float tube and do just fine with it. But I think it's more about how it works for you and how kind of in tune you are with that type of fishing and being down in a position like that. So I'll usually, when I'm working with guys, the way I'll teach that is we'll go out on the grass, and to practice casting, I'll actually have them sit on the ground and work that way. And it seems really awkward at first, but, you know, I'll always say, well, look, once you're down in a float tube, this is what it's going to be like, and that's kind of how much space you have to work from. And so if you can get used to that and how to work the line, and I tend not to be a really long caster either, and so it tends to work okay. And so using a 9-foot rod, and in my case, tends to work. If you like to throw a lot longer cast, or you're into a lot more kind of floating dry fly fishing, that might be a bit of a different answer. But I tend to go with the simplistic and to stick with stuff that I know. And usually I'll take a spare spool along or spools to change up lines and everything. But you won't see me carrying several rods on board or anything like that. And again, not that there's anything wrong with somebody's method of doing that. I've found more kind of the opposite, that 10 guys with 10 methods are all going to be right. And I don't think anybody's necessarily going to be wrong with that. It's all sort of up to the individual and what works best for you.
Do you usually fish out of a float tube, or is that what you prefer over a pontoon or
You're going to laugh, Roger, and I get laughed at by a lot of friends and neighbors, but I'm one of these diehard round float tube users. And anymore, it seems like I might be the last guy left on the planet who's doing that, but I kind of got stuck on that. I love how maneuverable, how seaworthy, how light they are, and how easy they are to transport. And I think I've spent probably too many hours in one where I've just gotten so used to it that I think the rest of the world would say it's really uncomfortable and awkward, and somehow it's just worked for me. I figured the day that I get too big or too heavy to be able to fit in one anymore, then I'll change up. Or when I can't find one for sale anymore, which
yeah,
could very well happen as well. You tend to see them less and less, but if you see a guy out on the water in one of those, you got half odds it's going to be me.
Okay. Dan Leibarger in Illinois asks, what is a good weight fly line to use in calm waters when one wants to make a cast without disturbing the mere surface as little as possible?
Yep. So, hi, Dan. So I'll color a little bit outside of the lines on this one as well. I think it probably has more to do with the way you're throwing the cast. And so I'll focus in that case, like if I'm either presenting a floating fly or going to something that I think is not very far underneath the surface, or like you say, calm or high visibility, I'll work on bringing the cast down gently when it hits the water instead of kind of bombing it out and having it slap down on the surface. But I think what the user does in that case and how you make the cast is going to have a heck of a lot more to do with your success and being and showing a better stealthy presentation versus a certain kind of line per se. And if you want to go into which lines might be better than others, I think it's probably less the weight or the rating of the line versus if you're talking floating lines. I know they actually, and I'm terrible with names and brands and things and telling you what works best and by which company. However, I know that the makers tend to have lines that present in a much more kind of supple, softer way if you're looking to present in that type of water versus one that just bombs out there like a missile. So it's probably a matter of if you're doing 5-weight or something lighter than that, if you're fishing kind of smaller water, smaller fish with 3-weight or something, to look for the lines that are actually made to go and lay out that way and come down gently.
And Ed Constantini in Wisconsin asks, Tim, when fishing still waters for trout, do you prefer sinking line or a sync tip for your presentation.
Mm-hmm.
And would you please speak to how you rigged the terminal tackle, i.e. tippet size and length?
Great. Hi, Ed. So that one for me, again, is a very simple. I love this question because I'm really known for subsurface presentation and using a full sink line when I fish, and I do that almost exclusively. So if I'm forced to the surface, I'll go there. But typically for me, I'll be in kind of that 5-weight range, regardless of the depth of the water or the distance below the surface I'm going to fish. And part of it, I'm unable to do that because I tend to do a faster retrieve. So I can even take a 5-weight, and if I only want to go down a couple or a few feet, I can still do it that way. So I kind of cheat in a little bit that way, but it works for me. But you see, probably what's most interesting about your question, though, is full sink versus sink tip. I run across a lot of people who their sink tip is really the only thing they're going to bring to the lake for subsurface. Either they're a little bit newer to it, or they're just more used to fishing moving water. And so typically in a stream scenario, that's how you're going to go underneath the surface, and there's kind of little to no use maybe for a full sink. So I tend to sort of preach that to newer lake fishers, that it's vital to learn how to use and to get into using a full sink line. And if you kind of think your way through some of the physics of that, particularly with a moving presentation, there's going to be a huge degree of difference between a full sink line and what a sink tip is going to be able to do as far as where it presents the fly in the water column. And I think intuitively, we tend to view the fly as being a lot deeper in the water than it is in reality. And so when you have a sink tip and you throw it out there and it goes down for a few seconds or however long you leave it, and then you strip it back, or if you're trolling it, I think the fly is going to lay a lot higher in the water than you might think it does. You'll picture it as, okay, the line's going out straight and there's a curve in it, and then the fly is sort of straight down or some degree of that. And once you move, and once you're pulling the line back or stripping it in, the fly's instantly going to lift.
Yeah.
And so there's going to be a big difference there between that. I think you'll be a lot closer to the surface with a sink tip.
What about intermediate sinking? That's something I use quite a bit in lakes. Is that not in your bag of tricks?
Less so. So I carry a Type 2, and even for a Type 2, it rides really high in the water. And so that's going to have to do with your preference as far as speed of retrieve, and also simply where you're going and where most of the activity tends to be. And I know there's a big importance to if you're up higher in the water column but you're not right on the surface. Of course, you don't necessarily want to disturb the surface, particularly in higher visibility with a floating line. And so you're going to want to get just under. And so that's going to be the thing to use. And again, why I kind of stray away from that and more toward a faster sinking line is simply because I go like crazy when I retrieve most of the time. And so most people look at that and say, you know, my God, why do you strip back so fast, and how does that work and everything? And it's a funny thing. I found that in terms of the results it gets, I'm not going to say it's any better or worse in terms of drawing strikes than a slower presentation, but I do think that what fish react to, we have a lot more sort of wiggle room than you might realize. And so if you and I are side by side and you're doing a slow retrieve and I'm at the same depth doing a really fast, violent retrieve, there's a good chance we're going to produce the same result. And then it just comes down to, well, what's your preference? Or if you think mentally one's better than the other, then you go to it. Because if you believe in it, you'll fish it, I think,
right,
more effectively.
Often. Yeah.
Yeah.
I had a question come in on the internet, Ed. Massachusetts. He says, what density sink line do you prefer?
So the one that I tend to use most all of the time, it's one of the Scientific Anglers, and it's been out there for quite a while, but it's a 5-weight Type 5 density compensated. I'm trying to remember specifically what they're calling it in this day and age. It's essentially what they had called the Unisync line for a long time, and I think they've got some version of the name kind of still out there. If you get into degrees of density and so forth, I'm a little bit less versed in that, and I know there's kind of a lot of lingo to go along with that. So probably the easiest, so at least you know what I'm using, is just to name off the type of line and the weighted. It's a weighted forward line, but they're popular, really common out there.
Okay. Let's talk about food and flies here. So what are the primary food sources found in lakes that you fish, and which ones are the most important, the most productive to imitate?
I like the very end of that, because you have certain food sources you're best to try and come up with a pretty close match, and maybe that more has to do with the size and how you position it versus something that looks, you know, exact in color, or the eyeballs are right, or something like that. At least mentally, that's how I look at it. So in the waters that I fish, some examples. So a Calabatus hatch on the surface, when you're fishing with a merger or a dry pattern, you tend to go after matching those a bit more closely, or in a lot of cases with midges as well. And I don't necessarily do vertical presentation, like with a strike indicator and sort of classic chronomid fishing myself. I tend to still go after most of those situations with a sinking line. And so, but if you're using those methods, then it really becomes a game of zeroing in on what's in the water and trying to do a size and a color match. And I know, moreover, a positioning match where you're going to go down and find the right depth where they're going to be feeding and everything. And a lot of those cases, midges tend to be an example, damsels another one, minnows a third, where I might not do a change up at all. I'll take the same semi-seal leech that I tend to like and go after them. And so sometimes it might close enough match what's in the water, and sometimes not at all. But if they're going to hit it, it's sort of like, if you're me, what do I care? And so the minute that I know you're out there, but then you're not going to react to me, then I'll start getting a bit more creative and looking to come up with something that's, in most cases, a bit closer of a match, at least size-wise and what it's doing in the water. And you do have some cases where you're going to go just the opposite. And like Daphnia is probably a good example, where how do you imitate something like that? So in my mind, I just throw a piece of steak in the middle of it, which in my world is going to be, again, a leech, and I'll go right through the middle of where the activity is. And if it works, it works. And a lot of it's trial and error, where it comes back to, again, the fish will tell me whether I had a change up or not. But typically, my style, if I'm getting the kind of reaction I'm looking for, then I keep it that simple. And even if it's really unconventional as far as what I'm presenting versus what's in the water and what they're feeding on, I usually tend to be a lot more driven by the reaction of the fish, or lack thereof. And that tells me kind of whether I'm on the right track or not.
Hey, Jake in Idaho wants to know, what's your list of top 10 flies for stillwater fishing is?
Okay. Hi, Jake. So I can make some pretty good recommendations. Now, you could be in a place where you've just taken this up and maybe you've come off the streams and are starting to look more at fishing stillwater, or maybe you've been at it for 50 years and you want to compare notes in either case. So I'm a little bit of a different sort in that I fish very few, oftentimes just one fly for most of the year. But if I were to tell somebody either new to it, or, you know, looking for a good well-rounded box, and if I'm going to hold it to 10, you know, what's a good 10 to have? So I'd start with a leech pattern. So mine, and all my friends will kind of laugh because they hear me say this all the time, and they only see me fish with this fly. But so I would say a semi-seal leech. I use a size 8, and it's beaded. And I use a color called Crawdad for no particular reason other than I like the color. So I would say that's probably one. I would say something in the form of a Calabatus emerger. And in my world, that's probably going to be something close to a size 14. So there's a lot of circumstances where that's a good, useful utility fly to fish on the surface. And then another one that's more just specific to me, and somehow I got onto it, and it tends to work in a lot of circumstances of high visibility, and if you're trying to put something small out to a big fish near the shoreline, for instance, there's one called a Pablo's Cripple. which is kind of along similar lines to the other one, the merger that I mentioned. But for some reason, I've gotten onto that, and I really like how it looks, how it sits in the water, and it tends to be a lighter color. So for me at my age, I can see it. I also like that, and yet it's a smaller pattern, but that one tends to be good. A gold rib hare's ear, probably around a size 12. Again, just as a good utility nymph is a good pattern. Let's see, I'm up to four here. So another one, a halfback nymph is a good other. And you can see there's sort of a theme here that I use kind of general common utility flies. And so I think if you have two or three good floating patterns, again, kind of in the middle range size-wise, so kind of 14, 16, and then some search patterns like a leech or woolly bugger. A lot of people like those. Woolly bugger in sort of a darker color, that tends to be a good kind of all-around utility fly. And then something along the lines of a smaller nymph. And so, Roger, you were talking about fishing kind of closer to the surface but not on the surface. So something like a small hare's ear or halfback or something with that kind of a profile that could be size, you know, kind of 12, 14. And less weight to it than, you know, the bead-headed stuff that I tend to throw can be really effective.
What about, you know, you mentioned woolly bugger and leech, which are kind of similar. But what about other streamers? You didn't mention any streamers.
Yep. Sorry. I got on kind of a little bit of a roll with the nymphs and some of the floating flies. But I tend to like minnow patterns, and where I fish, I'll even go into ones that are tied or recommended for saltwater use. So things that guys around here might typically chase coho or sea run cutthroat with, I'll take those into the lakes, sometimes either because they're smaller bait fish patterns, or I've been known to take certain ones, and maybe it's tied in a 2 or 3 inch length. I might cut it down to an inch, inch and a half to suit my own purposes. And in a lot of those cases, again, it's not so much to directly imitate the food that's in the water. If you know, for instance, it's fathead minnows or something similar, I'll try to go with something that in the conditions that I'm fishing in, whether you're going into kind of a darker, more evening circumstance or kind of rough versus calm water, or simply where the food and the fish are mostly positioned, there'll be kind of a variety of that pattern or minnow pattern that I'll want to have on hand. And I might change and go to two or three different ones in an outing just as conditions change and you see the fish react differently to different things. And so, for example, as it gets darker later into the evening, I'll start to size up and go bigger and bigger. But there's probably three or four different minnow patterns that I'll carry just to have that variety with me, but something along those lines. And then some of the kind of more classic or older school patterns, the dace and some of those types that you see that are kind of have a thinner profile, I like to play and experiment with some of those. And admittedly, I've got some in the box that I don't even recall what they're called, but it's just that, okay, that sort of size, that profile, or something that's really lightweight that I want to lay down in really shallow water, or, well, I know there's a lot of activity, and so I don't want to bomb something in there and kind of set them off. I'll look for something like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Time to take a quick break here again, and when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about flies and then dive into some strategy and tactics here, so stick with us, folks. Baja Fly Fishing Company is dedicated to fulfilling your vacation dreams, and just so there's no mistake, they derive as much pleasure from helping a novice improve as they do fishing with a pro. From the casual to the hardcore, they can match your expectations with their experience and coaching. A vacation with Baja Fly Fishing is more than a fishing trip. It's a full-on Baja experience that you will remember forever. They know the Baja after 40 years of traveling its back roads, kayaking its shoreline, surfing and snorkeling, while pioneering the fly fishing techniques that have evolved into the tactics used today. They are well-versed in fly fishing the beach, in kayaks, on pongas, and are well-versed in all tackle types. Join them in pursuit of roosterfish, dorado, marlin, sailfish, wahoo, jack crevalle, yellowfin, skipjack, and many other species. Learn more about Baja Fly Fishing Company by visiting their website at www.bajaflyfish.com. That's bajaflyfish.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Tim Lockhart about Stillwater Simplified. If you'd like to ask Tim a question, go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, Tim, let me check some of those questions in here. We'll hold some of these until we get to tactics. This one I'm not quite sure of. Edward wrote in, are there any conditions in stillwater fishing you've encountered where the trout might suffer from barotrauma? I don't know if that's
barotrauma. Yeah, that one's not quite as familiar to me as well, either.
I don't know what, Edward, what you mean by barotrauma. It's the first time I've seen that word, too. So maybe if you want to clarify it, we can try to address it. But okay, so back, Rick Takahashi, he asks, what qualities do you feel are important to use when tying materials, or when tying the patterns you use, i.e. slender versus robust shape, impressionistic versus realistic? And then he asked about particular sizes for a bunch of different flies here. But can you kind of address that and how you feel about that?
Yep. Hi, Rick. So one more shout-out. I circled your name because not only did you give us repeat business here, but you did the most questions, and I could see in some cases the most in-depth questions as well. So thank you for taking the time and for well-thought-out questions that you wrote about. This is really cool to see. So along those lines, so I can answer the question. One little dirty little secret that I'm going to offer here, and I have many when it comes to fly fishing and stillwater fly fishing, but I don't tie my own flies. I'm one of those persons, one of those people who will buy versus tie. And a lot of that having to do with, when you think about the last few years, any kind of waking moment that I've had indoors, I've spent writing and putting together what eventually became these books. And so that's kind of where all my time went. So that left pretty much no time at a vice to tie my own. So hopefully you won't hold it against me too much, and it sort of goes to the point of each of us is unique and individual, and you can certainly make this sport what you want it to be, and if some of those things about you are unconventional, you're not alone. That's definitely me. But in terms of stuff you're asking about, sort of do I key in on more the impressionistic versus realistic, I like that because I'm definitely on the impressionist side. So I tend to go with sort of a rough, I don't even want to call it a match, but I'll prioritize by size and again, in some cases, weight or how the fly is going to either ride on the surface of the water or how it's going to come down or how fast it's going to sink versus trying to get it to look specifically like a certain food source. And in my case, and I'm definitely, again, I'm not calling that wrong necessarily. It just has to do with sort of what's actually interesting or fun to you or what you believe to work the best. And so for me, I try and look more at the conditions, what's going on in the water. Visibility is a great big one for me. So I look at the lake surface and is it smooth versus a little more roughed up or choppy or somewhere in between. And I'm big on what the sky looks like. So are we talking gray skies, gloomy skies, going into hours of dusk or darkness, or is the sun hanging overhead and it's shining right down into perfectly calm surface? And then I'll kind of go from there and make my best educated guess as far as, you know, size up, size down. I want to make less of an impression of the water. In some cases, I want to make a big impression in the water, and I'll go more toward that kind of an approach. And then I've had kind of a one example, I guess, of a sort of a more aggressive approach would be like in the fall, and where I fish, we'll get these minnows that'll come in, and it's really prolific, and at a certain part of the year, in certain conditions, they'll all be packed along the shoreline, and the trout, and particularly the biggest ones in the lake, are right on top of them feeding, and they're anything but bashful. And so you'll find days where if you can find that circumstance with less visibility, so if you got some wind happening and the water's roughed up and the skies are dark or it's even raining or pouring rain, I'll tend to go in with something that's a bigger, heavier approach, and I'm trying to get noticed in that case. If there's just a lot of kind of chaos going in the water and you're trying to get a fly notice, and it tends to be really effective to go in and go at them that way. So it just depends on kind of your circumstances and what's going on the day of, and you want to have stuff available that you can kind of change with conditions and with what, not just what the fish are doing and how they're feeding, but moreover, what they're reacting to. And you may have to experiment a bit and change up and see, okay, well, how am I going to draw a reaction here? And again, let them tell you kind of what the best approach is.
So in those darker conditions, you're going bigger and darker in your coloring? Is that
typically, yeah, and more aggressive in the approach and how I'm going in. And I might lay more casts into an area than I might typically, or I'll be less afraid of spooking the fish, just because if I've observed enough, in a lot of cases, they've sometimes appeared to throw caution to the wind, and they're more concerned with, you know, for this window of time while the opportunity's there, they're going to go in and they're going to seize it. And in lower visibility, I think instinctively, they're sort of less concerned about other predators. And where I fish, we get a lot of eagles and osprey and things that come down from the air, and we'll take fish that way. And I do think there's some degree of instinct where there's an awareness, okay, if things above the lake surface can see me, I'm going to be a bit more cautious and conservative versus if things are kind of rougher, darker, I'll take more chances. And at least the behavior would prove that out.
Rick's got that other question about what sizes do you favor for, and he lists chronomids, calabatus, damsels, caddis, waterbone. It's got quite the list here.
I like
some
the
of those
here.
If you use
them? Yeah. Overall, I tend to go smaller in a lake, and I know a lot of guys like to come in and sort of toss the bigger, more exciting patterns, and particularly it gets later in the evening, or if you're chasing larger fish, I know conventional wisdom as well, present larger food to them, and that's certainly not a bad way to go. I think my own experience and preference and everything would be to stick with something on the side of smaller, unless, again, it's just not proving to be effective, or I start to get the idea that, okay, conditions are telling me to do otherwise. But typically, looking at his list here.
When you say smaller, so damn smaller than
mm-hmm.
what? I mean.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. So, like,
you need to have some kind of reference here.
Yeah, that's true. A benchmark here. So, like damsels, for instance, you might typically see those presented in a size 8 or 10. And if I'm going to go either side of that, I'll go smaller. So I'll go kind of toward 12 or something with less of a profile in the water. And I've seen where, well, brown trout are a good example where you don't necessarily have to go big to attract a strike. I think in a lot of cases, surprisingly, they'll key in on stuff that's a lot smaller than you might think they'd be willing to look at. And I think in their case, food is food. So I try not to do something that's necessarily going to set them off, like in shallow water, for instance. So typically, I'll stick with kind of a smaller pattern than somebody might typically use, or if it's getting kind of later on in the evening and people are starting to throw pretty large streamers or minnow patterns or something like that, I'm a little more hesitant to go to something that's a lot bigger myself. And again, it's just experience that kind of drives that for me.
Well, for some of these when you're talking water boatmen or caddis or so forth,
mm-hmm.
what size do you use?
So on, like, caddis flies, for instance, so those I'll kind of go 14, 16 for something like that. Calabatus, for instance, if I'm fishing a hatch, I'll go, like, on the surface, kind of same thing, 14, 16. And in some of those cases, again, it's going to be something not only where I have considerations for what's going to attract fish or what's going to be best in the given conditions and circumstances. I might simply have part of it come down to what can I see and what's visible. So,
what
and for the color. Yep.
You mentioned scuds. Do you fish scuds often, or are those available up in where you fish?
Less often. So, yeah, we definitely have them in the water. And I have kind of limited experience with those, and typically when they've been more kind of prolific, I've simply just been fishing a different pattern. So, you know, in my case, that's going to be a leech or a hare's ear nymph or something like that. So I haven't found a lot of circumstances where I'm actually going to go to that and think that that is the fly of choice. And again, that's just what's going on in my head. And I tend to go toward something that I'm either familiar with or that I simply believe in, at the, you know, and for no particular reason. But I do have a thing about if you have something on and you're not quite confident with it, I would say go to something that you feel better about, because again, I think you're going to fish it differently. And so yeah, some of these and like water boatman is a good example. We just, where I fish, we see less of that than we would see typically a lot of other stuff. Midges and calabatus and damsel nymphs and minnows where I go. And so you kind of go with the stuff that you've spent the most time around.
Yeah. Corey in Concord, New Hampshire asks, says, fishing many of the remote trout ponds in my home waters of New Hampshire by float tube, I have found my go-to flies to be the 88 as a point fly and the white usual as a chopper. Tied about 3 feet back. If you had two flies to choose from, no matter what the conditions, just, I know I just made things very difficult, a bit more difficult, what would they be? So he's looking for, you know, go ahead and answer that. And I've got something
to talk about. Hey, Corey, I would counter that you're making things more fun, actually. So you throw a curveball or two, and it makes it a bit more interesting. And anything that's going to get Roger and me laughing is probably a good thing. But I like the choices you have here. Again, I would tend to go really sort of, in my definition, conventional or I'd venture to say boring. So I'd probably, if I were going to do a two-fly setup, I wouldn't take off the leech that I use, half because I'm lazy and half because I don't think anything else is going to produce any better than that, or worse necessarily. And then for the drop, I'd probably go with a small hare's ear pattern, so probably 12 or 14, something in that range. And whatever it is about the hare's ear, I've had good experience with it, and it's that fly for some reason has been unusually nice to me over the years, and whatever it is about that. But it kind of goes back to I tend to stick with the stuff that is straightforward and really simplistic in appearance.
Yeah.
Whatever it is about that. I tend to like that. It tends to suit me.
Yeah, and there's a private lake that I fish here, just 5 minutes from my house. And a lot of times, the dropper that I use is just a green caddis pupa. And I get a lot of fish on that dropper. And I was recently down on this big reservoir in southern Colorado, and the fish were rising. They were just rise, you know, patterns all over the place. But they weren't hitting on the surface. They were hitting below the surface. And again, I said, I'm going to try what I use in my home lake and caddis pupa. And boy, I caught 6 fish within 40 minutes in about a 20 by 20 foot area. I didn't even move my feet. I was standing.
Don't you love that?
And, all on below the surface. I guess you just have to try different things and see what's up, and I didn't see a caddis in the air, so, you know.
And that's the thing, and you hit on something huge, too, is if you find something, you get a reaction to it, you start having success, maybe you'll figure out why, and maybe you won't, but it's kind of in the moment, who cares? If whatever's in the water, whatever they're feeding on, is night and day different from what you're throwing at them, you have better information now by way of the strike than to look at what's going on, what's in the water, try and match it, try and imitate it, everything like that. At least in my own experience, the more I try to get really technical and exact about coming up with whatever that magic formula is, the further away I get from sort of the action and actually drawing strikes and doing what I set out to do on the water. And so I never worry about if it's something that's unexplainable, maybe that makes it even more interesting, and maybe that tells us something about the trout that it might be a bit unconventional or less intuitive.
We've got a couple of questions that are similar. Jeff again in Erie, Colorado, and Matt in Kamloops, BC.
Mm-hmm.
Jeff asked, how do you determine where trout are feeding? And Matt asked, how do you find feeding fish in still waters? I've had heard birds and structure, but mm-hmm. find my success really has these two things. So can you kind of address where you find the trout that are feeding?
Yeah, and so that's always an interesting puzzle, because the thing particularly about still water and even versus going out in the streams or maybe in the salt where I am, is there is this sort of overwhelming abundance of I'll call it mystery meat. And you go out and you might spend half a day looking around, searching, feeling pretty lost and pretty blind. And so I would tell anybody, first of all, that's normal, and that's Lakes Forest, and that's what makes it so interesting and challenging. And those of us that are kind of addicted to the puzzle-solving factor in it, it's right up our alley. So it's sort of like I answer a lot of questions here in the job that I do. The first thing you say is it depends, and then everybody rolls their eyes. But you find that there's a lot of possibilities and variation out there, and it all comes down to, you know, in that particular day and in a particular moment, we've got to sort of put the pieces together and figure out for that one circumstance what's going on and what's going to work. But in terms of, okay, how am I going to locate them? So again, and to sound really typical of the stuff that I've written, I start with the timing. And I know that's a whole subject matter that you could speak to for hours and hours, but really you're trying to, in simple terms, zero in on when the bite's going to happen in a day before you set about looking for sort of the most ideal places in the lake to look for them. And then you sort of go from there. And then as far as getting to the where, let's say we've determined that, okay, for whatever reason, we figured out the bite's on. So then for me, if I don't have kind of clues to go on, and it sort of dips into Matt's question below it, but if the evidence isn't floating around in the air in some form or another, or in the water, or visible movement of the fish, then I'll resort to conducting this thing that I call a blind search, where I'll take just a very simple, you can call it scientific or statistic, but in any case, it's something very simple. I'll section off the lake, and let's say if we make it really easy and say, okay, I'm going to split it up for three different areas or area types in the lake, I'll simply say, okay, I want to search the shoreline or up against the banks. Okay, that's number one. Number two, I'm going to want to find the shoals or the shallow areas, expanse, wherever that's going to be, or if there's several of them, those opportunities in a lake. And so maybe that is, let's call it 3 to 8 feet of water for some length of the lake floor between surface and floor. And then the third part of it being out in the depths, or simply we'll just call it out across the middle, and that can be number three. So usually I'll start with the shoals, because that tends to be the most typical place where, if the bite's on, that's going to be where they're going to feed in most circumstances. Not always, but given that you have more vegetation in the water because it's more shallow, and so the light can penetrate and get down there and actually cause for vegetation, and then, you know, from there, food sources. So I'll always start there, preference I have. And I won't give it forever to conduct the search in each given area. So I'll give it, I mean, typically 5 or 10 minutes. And part of that is I at least feel confident that, okay, if they're there, I can find them pretty quick. If they're not there, I can determine that pretty quick as well. So don't think that you have to spend an hour searching along the shoal before you decide, well, I'm going to go check along the banks. So that can be a matter of minutes, 5, 10 minutes. In some cases, and if I'm really familiar with an area and what typically goes on, that might just be a small handful of casts. And then I'll go conduct the same thing up against the shoreline, work that area, not give it a whole heck of a lot of time, because if they're there, they're going to tell me so sooner than later. And if the answer is no in those two areas, then I'm going to head out toward the middle. And I'll search, and I'll do kind of a variety of depths. And again, with, okay, if I go out and I typically use a Type 5 sinker, I can pretty easily check that area closer to the surface, go deeper down, count it down, and again, within kind of 5-10 minutes, I can usually determine, okay, after doing this search of those three typical areas of a lake, and if there's just nothing going on and nothing visible, then it's like, okay, well, it's not the end of the world. The bite's simply not on. But you can determine that in, you know, more of like a 20, 30-minute time span versus it's going to take me 2 hours to figure out if they're on or off. It typically doesn't take that long. And then you go into the mode of, okay, if I've determined that it's off, then I start asking the questions surrounding when do I think it'll most likely come on in the day. Or it might be as simple as, well, how much time do I have? And can I stay here all day? Or do I need to be home, you know, for supper or to get to the honeydew list or whatever it is? It's going to be, simply put, a question more of that type of situation versus, okay, scientifically, can I predict when they're going to come on?
Yeah,
it just
or
depends
you come
on
back
how much
next time and fish
mm-hmm.
in the morning rather than the afternoon or whatever.
Yep. But in all of that, it's all simple logic and common sense. So I at least myself, I say all the time, if there is rocket science to be applied to this, I haven't found any and I don't know any. As disappointing as that may be to some, but it tends to be a really simplistic common sense process. And I would tell anybody that, you know, kind of the mindset you want to have is that in a lot of cases, it's not so much intuitive because the fruit is lower hanging than we may take it to be, and the answers might be a lot simpler, and so we tend to look past what that is and look to the more complicated, the more difficult, the more sophisticated. And at least when you're me, it doesn't yield much or it doesn't yield anything. I tend to get more lost in all of that stuff.
Parker in Montana, to continue on with this.
Yep.
Let me read his question because he put a lot into it. He says, whether it be fly patterns, colors, equipment, or retrieval techniques, each of the many deep mid-elevation lakes, 5,000 to 7,000 feet, I fish here in southwest Montana, have their own unique quirks, as you've been describing as well. If you were to fish one of these mountain lakes for the first time without any prior knowledge of it, how would you approach it, assuming you were fishing entirely subsurface? What patterns, lines, leaders would you fish and attempt to figure it out? So you kind of just went through that whole routine of how you would figure out the lake. So I'm going to narrow this down to what would be your search pattern?
Yep. So, Parker, by the way, I just circled you, not because you've got repeat business on here, but because you went to good length in this question, and I like it, and it's kind of right up my alley in terms of what you asked. So I do fish myself. I don't necessarily go into that sort of elevation range, but in my area, I love to go into kind of a 1 and 2,000 foot range where you've got, you know, maybe a mile or two to hike in, and for that reason you're not going to find anybody or very few who are going to take a float tube and go into those areas on foot. So I tend to enjoy that experience. But I don't do a whole lot, if anything, different than I might typically do to show up in a lowland lake and get in at the launch and paddle out. So still, I'm going to take the leech that I like to use, the same line. Where I might go different in a case like that, and with it being unfamiliar water, and those lakes in my area tend to be a lot more kind of, you can call it complex in terms of the structure in the water, which in simple terms means a lot more down trees and things in the water that I don't typically know they're there because I'm not there as often. So I'm probably going to go with, let's say, a backup outfit. So I might use a spare rod and have it outfitted with an old line that I don't typically use in a lower lake, simply because my odds of snagging up onto something and either breaking off or losing or ruining gear go up. So if I do anything different, that's the first thing I'm going to do, is try and spare my newer gear because I'm not as familiar. And in those types of lakes, you're working close to a lot of, we'll call it junk that's in the water, and you can't necessarily see it. And being a bit more clumsy than the average person, I'm not the most coordinated guy out there. So if I hang up, there's actually odds that I'm either going to, believe it or not, break a fly line or snap a tip and trying to get myself out of trouble. And so that tends to be the most practical thing for me. But in terms of the fly I'm going to present and how I'm going to go after fish and search for them, it's very similar to what I do in typical lowland lakes. And what I love is that because you have different circumstances, water that is much less pressured, if at all, different environment, different food sources, I find in most cases, at least where I'm going, that the fish tend to be more willing than average versus tricky. And when I find that it gets really difficult and you'd think there's just nothing in the water or the lake is barren, most times what's going to prove out is if I can wait around and an hour or two later go back at it the same way, the problem will take care of itself. So pretty easy, simple stuff that I'll stick with, and a lot of that recipe is very much the same, particularly the fly.
There was a question on chronomid fishing.
Yep.
Yeah, but you don't do a lot of that, right?
Yeah, and I'll tell you, around here, it's a really popular way to fish, and somehow I've ended up sort of avoiding that. I think just because I tend to be so simplistic in my means and in my background. So I came into fly fishing, a spoon fisherman before that, and I love spinning gear and spoons, and I was the same way. I got on to my favorite spoon and my favorite kind of method and everything like that, and I would approach everything in life with that spoon. And so I've kind of, in time, adapted that to the way that I fly fish. And over time, the variety of gear and flies, lines, everything that I typically use, keeps getting narrower and narrower to where I'm literally almost at the point of one fly, one line, one rod and reel. So that kind of somehow kept me away from getting proficient with vertical and using strike indicators and being able to fish in that way. And probably what's interesting about that is it is so popular here in this area, and I know north of the border into Canada as well. It's wildly popular, and it, in certain circumstances, it's the deadliest thing on the water.
Bruce in Hat Creek, California, he says, I fish private ponds that are CNR, I guess, catch and release. During the calabatus hatch, the trout feed voraciously. Other times, you would swear the ponds are devoid of fish. Any hints to attract fish when there is no hatch? The ponds are mostly 3 to 8 feet deep.
Bruce, I had a really similar experience for the time that I lived in London. And so I ended up with a favorite place that I would go, and it was as is typical of the UK. So it was more of kind of a pay-to-play club called Halliford Mere. And typically a lot of the ponds there were really shallow. They had great big fish in them, and a lot of them. And at times it was like you say, whether you're seeing that they're there or not, in terms of how they reacted or didn't react, you'd think that there was just nothing in the water, or, okay, what's going on? Are these fish overpressured? Are they used to seeing people all the time and they're just getting bored with food and flies and everything? It's kind of like, well, you don't really know. So part of that equation for me was typically over there, they use floating lines regardless of the presentation. I think partly because it's the most popular kind of form of sport for them is to present that way. And where I was, the water tended to be really shallow, and so that was kind of the preferred method. And it's like, well, no matter where you throw it in the pond, they're going to see it because they don't have very far to look for it. And so that was kind of the conventional wisdom. They weren't against using a sinking line or a full sink. It was just that, okay, well, you can use that if you want, but people tend not to, and our favorite method tends to be more of a floating line and presentation that's going to sit higher in the water column. They tend to go to a lot smaller nymph patterns and things, stuff that you and I would look at and say, well, that's tiny. How are they ever even going to see that? But it's what they like to do over there. So I went a little bit unconventional, and I started presenting with a sinking line. And I think there's probably some logic out there beyond simply can they see it, where sometimes, and it can be unexplainable, and that's okay, but they're going to take the subsurface presentation or something that you went down with a sinking line and strip through the lower parts of the water column, even if it's not much of a water column, versus approaching it from the surface. And again, even if I can't explain it, but they react to it and it works, that's fine. And maybe I can kind of figure out what happened later. But for me, typically, if I can't figure it out later, that's okay too. I don't mind having the mystery in it. If it gave me results, I like that about what we do. So the other part of that was, again, and I know I mentioned timing pretty regularly here, but I got to know the gamekeeper at that club pretty well, and so he started sort of allowing me to go outside of the lines a little bit, and if I wanted to come in before hours, before they opened, and kind of at first light, even if that's 2 hours before they opened at that time of the year, he said, oh, that's okay. Just go in and fish it and then come check in after we open. So I took advantage of that and started seeing this area at different times when I wouldn't typically see it. And I got a lot better at kind of keying in on, okay, these are the parts of the day when a lot of these problems that you speak of sort of go away and they right themselves. And so I started spending a lot of time early morning like that. And I also did that at the other end of the day. And I can remember in the middle of the summer being out there till just about 10 o'clock at night. Nobody's telling me to leave, and they know I'm out there, and so I'm going to experiment and see what goes on in those hours. And there's a whole lot that you see with just the timing of it itself. And, okay, if it gets darker and they react and they come out, fine and good.
Yeah, yeah. We've got a few more questions. We've got to try to wrap this up here.
Yep.
Dan in Miami, he says, what percentage of time do trout spend in the middle of the water column compared to the bottom? Mid-column and surface seem very low probability in my experience, but maybe I'm not doing it right. So what would you say to Dan?
Hey, Dan. So hopefully I can deliver on this last part of the question. Hopefully this radio show helps. I'll do my best here. But again, in a lot of that, you don't necessarily have the answer, or I may not be able to sit here and tell you specifically how to go about that. And that's okay. Because a lot of the stuff that is going to transpire in a day when you go out, it is a lot of mystery meat, and sometimes the only way to find out the answer to that stuff is just to go out there, take the time, and experiment, and keep yourself out there for as long as you can. But you're not alone in that, so mid-column and surface being very low probability. So I tend to be one that goes subsurface and down into the depths more often than not. And I think just typical of lakes, given the topography, the landscape, where the opportunities are, where the food is, where the most, I'll call it the most comfortable water, and that has to do with a lot of times temperature and the stability of that. And so a lot of the time that's simply going to be down in those lower depths. And so then it becomes a game of, how do I get down there? And much more important than what do I use to go down there? Because I think the biggest thing people struggle with, particularly early on in fishing lakes, is getting the fly down to where the activity most likely is, or simply where the fish are. And so you'll see, kind of simplify that, you see a lot of guys using lime green out there, line color, meaning they're using floating lines, to fish in water where in reality, a lot of the action might be 8 or 10 or 12 feet down. Well, they're simply not going to get down to that level with their fly, and it's as easy as that. And so if you start getting proficient with these full sink lines that we keep talking about so that you can get down into those areas, it's not necessarily a sin to not be able to catch fish in the upper, let's say the upper half of the water column, simply because a lot of the time, again, they're just not there. And so there's got to be something that brings them up to that part of the water column, whether that's food or conditions, the hatch, or simply the sun fell below the trees. And so instinctively, they're going to come up and out. But if you're not there at the right time when they're going to be up there, then you're absolutely right. There's not opportunity up there. So the first thing I would say is, get into practice and figure out one way or the other how to get down into those lower depths. And again, a lot of the times, that's where they're going to be.
Yeah, I think we have time for maybe one more question here.
Mm-hmm.
John in Ohio, he says, I fish Quagama Lake in Ontario for wild brook trout. It is up to 140 feet deep with very limited vegetation. There is absolutely no inflowing water. The fish seem to bite twice a day for very short periods. What can I do to get more hits in the off hours? I wade and float tube primarily. I would try dynamite, but the lodge owner found something.
Hey, John, so I like the way that you phrased this question. So, and brookies are interesting. So of all the species that I fish for around here, and that includes cutties and rainbows and brown, one or two others, brookies tend to be the most kind of unique and different in terms of how you give chase and how you get them simply to stick to the hook. I tend to have to be more creative to get them to stick for whatever reason that is where I fish. And a lot of the times, and you talk about these windows when they are active, so there's no problem finding them and drawing the strike and everything, but it can be horribly frustrating getting to step two, setting the hook and getting them to stay for whatever reason that is. But if you're talking the in-between times and being creative and how do I sort of find some semblance of action, the first thing I would say is, at least if you ask me, it's worth fishing in those times. And when it's slow, whether it's between two prolific kind of times of the day when the bite is on, or if you're just simply going to go out in a day, either it's winter time or whatever it is that makes the bite less than ideal, a lot of what I've learned is from trying to survive, so to speak, in those times of a lot slower circumstances. So definitely go after that and spend the time and see how much you can learn being creative and sort of forcing yourself to stay out and figure out ways to catch fish. Because there are opportunities at those times. It's just it's less than. But I find the stuff that you pick up in fishing those parts of the day, there's a lot of value in that to learning to be creative and to try and make something out of nothing. But to try, at least attempt to get a little bit more specific in that way, I would say, whatever it is that you found was working when the bite was on and when you were catching a lot of fish, go the opposite, search other areas of the lake, search other depths, and try and go to sort of the unconventional and keep experimenting and keep changing. And most of all, don't spend 30 minutes letting them tell you no. Give it 5, 10, and then move on to something else.
And there's always the flask and a good cigar. And
see, Roger always has better answers in this stuff. He's been doing this
for
a while.
Well, we did a show on Silver Creek in Idaho not too long ago, and literally that's what our guide said. Is there's just times of day where, you know, it's just an exercise in frustration, you know. You might as well.
Absolutely.
And he says, there's so much activity on the dry fly that guys will just, if the bite's not on, they'll just sit on the bank and have a drink and talk until it's back on.
Yeah, and if you think your way to the ends and actually why am I out here, okay, well, if it's not the catching part at a certain time of the day, okay, well, am I doing something that's fun, that I enjoy?
Yeah.
Okay,
exactly.
And if the answer to that is yes, then it kind of doesn't matter about the rest of it. They'll come out when they come out.
Yeah.
That is the reality of it.
Yeah.
I like that.
Well, we've got to wrap it up here, Tim, and we've got a few more things to do here. We're going to give away that one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, and also a copy of your book, Stillwater Simplified, courtesy of Stackpole Books. And if you want to learn about other books that Stackpole publishes, go to stackpolebooks.com, stackpolebooks.com, and you can check out all the publications they have there. Great, great publisher. We work with them often, as you all well know. So just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave the website tonight, take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section of tonight's show that says, what did you think of that show? Just click on that link and give us your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Okay, now it's time to give away a few prizes. And the first thing we're going to do is for the drawings, and we're going to give away that one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. If you are the lucky winner, we'll contact you after the show and so that we can get information from you on how to receive your gift, because we do have your email address. So the one-year membership to the International Federation of Fly Fishers, and if you want to find out more about that organization, go to fedflyfishers.org, fedflyfishers.org. And let's see, fire up the database here, and looks like Roger Campbell is in Wyoming. You just got yourself a one-year membership to the International Federation of Fly Fishers, so congrats, Roger. And Now we'll give away that one-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal from Amato Books, and go to amatobooks.com, and you can find out about the other periodicals and books that they have that they publish. So check them out. And our winner there is Matt Andreese in D.C. So congratulations, Matt, and we'll get you hooked up with that that subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. All right, now we'll give away Tim's book. Let me just clear my queue. So this is going to be a two-part question. And, Rod, you got a lot of questions in here that we didn't get to. But thanks for asking anyway. Maybe next time. I try to get to the questions that are sent in advance first, just so you guys know. So if it's really important, get it in first on the website, and then we address the rest of these. And here is, just to fill in the gap here, because I know you'd be interested too, Tim, Edward wrote back and he says, barotrauma is a condition experienced by some deep water fish that are brought quickly to the surface. Barotrauma often sustain serious injuries and upon release are unable to swim or dive back to depth. I think trout might be able to equilibrate. So, yeah, I don't know. I've heard of that now that you mentioned it.
Yeah.
But I think it's usually, you know, like if you're fishing for lake trout or something, or maybe deep sea fishing, that is the case. I think in most of the shallower trout lakes, I don't think you have a big problem with that. But now
yeah.
I know what you're talking about. So thanks.
Yep.
Thanks, Ed, for the explanation. Appreciate that. Okay, so Rod says, keep it simple, stupid. he liked your approach. Yeah.
I'm glad someone out there can relate.
Yeah. Okay, looks like we've got the queue cleared here of questions. And the question is, two-part question. Tim mentioned that when he's searching a lake that he may have not fished before, he goes to three parts of the lake, and he prefers one part of the lake. So what part of the lake is that? What kind of structure is there? And then what is his favorite search pattern? So give me those two answers, and the first person that does that correctly will win Tim's book. So now we just have to wait. And I'm running out longer here tonight because I know we took about 5 minutes futzing around to make sure everybody was hearing us, so that's why we're running over tonight, folks. So.
The good thing is we're having a good time. So at least
I'll
on this end, it's all fine and good.
It.
Yes.
Yeah. So I'm waiting for an answer here. Let's see, deepest part in a leech. Not what I was looking for. The leech is right. Right,
yes.
Tim?
Beadhead semi-seal leech.
And looks like, this answer is shoreline shoals middle. Well, you didn't tell us what fly, though, Ed. So we're not giving it to you. It's a two-part question. Oh, it's Roger Campbell. You're a winner tonight. Shoals and leech. So
there
that's
it is.
What we were looking for. Yeah.
Okay. Well, we couldn't stump Roger then. So he won twice, didn't he?
Well, he won the drawing.
That's just
plain luck because it's a random search of the database.
It's good to be Roger. That's all I'm going to say.
Yeah. So, yeah, I'm giving him preferential treatment because of his name.
I figured much.
Yeah. So, Roger, send me your address in the same text box that you just answered the question, and we'll get that out to you. So, from Stackpole. So, thanks for playing, and all of everybody, and next time, make sure you guys get into the registration database so that you can get a chance at some of these drawing prizes. And, of of course, always take good notes during the show, and you can answer these questions. Well, Tim, I really want to thank you for being on the show again with us tonight, coming back for a second round, and talking more about Stillwaters.
Yeah.
And thanks a lot.
Yeah, likewise, Roger. I really appreciate you having me back, and I wanted to also directly say thanks to your audience out there for everyone's involvement and all of the great questions that were sent. So that's really fun for me to be involved with. And I can see I'm going to have to produce a third book so I can come back again. I've got my work cut out for me here. I had a great time.
Or when you find that secret method for those down periods, those doldrums, you know,
that's what it is.
We'll want to hear about it, you know.
And I'm going to go figure out what the rocket science is because I really want to know.
Yeah, right. Our next broadcast will be on October 4th, 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. And on that show, I'll interview Dave Karzinski. And our topic for the show will be smallmouth bass strategies. Dave is passionate about smallmouth. Smallmouth bass are in more streams, rivers, lakes, and reservoirs than any other game fish. So join us and learn about the cutting-edge techniques and fly patterns being used today to catch these exciting game fish. We'd like to thank the International Federation of Fly Fishers, Amato Books, Whitfray Key Fishing Lodge, and Watermaster, and Baja Fly Fishing Company for sponsoring our show. Don't forget to visit our website at Ask About Fly Fishing and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.